welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back and to talk all things spreading of the message. It's odd to say that with a happiness because this is such a devastating thing as it relates to Christianity that's going on, message spreading across the world. And it's just so interesting to me because whenever you see people who are in other countries and their version of the message has grown into something weird, I don't know how to say it other than weird. In the main sect, we would see all of these people. They would come in at Easter and they would have these big conventions. And, you know, they would unite us as like we were one people. But when you got to know them, you realized just how weird and different what they believed was compared to what we believed. And yet it's all the same message. They had the same foundation. But anyway, it's interesting to talk about how it spread into, I guess now we're going into the Caribbean and to South America.
Yeah, John, I'm looking forward to picking back up. If our listeners remember over our last two episodes, we've been talking about how the message spread to the ends of the world after William Branham died. And overall, if our listeners have been with us since we started this new series following the years after William Branham died, the message had a major schism in 1967, 1968, and coming into 1969, this massive missionary push began, which took the message everywhere. And if you'll remember, the way that it got started, or they initially went after the low-hanging fruit, I'll put it like that. There were about 35 message churches back then, and leaders and ministers associated with the message, they began to go to this to the broader Latter Rain movement, where William Branham had name recognition, where the people knew of him and had some familiarity with his message. And some were even contained people who already believed the message and they just weren't in a message church. They were a message believer in a UBC church. They were a message believer in a Independent Assemblies of God church. They were a message believer in Foursquare. Just people William Branham had picked up into his cult of personality but hadn't moved to a message church. And so initially they're going after that low-hanging fruit in all these churches. And at that point, the message preachers and leaders were still welcome in most all of those places. They were especially welcome in the Independent Assemblies of God. The Independent Assemblies, many of their churches were still part of Independent Assemblies of God back then. And that was probably their most important and fertile recruiting ground. After that, the UPC and other apostolic churches were also just very important places for them to recruit from. And then in Africa, the Apostolic Faith Mission. And so as that's happening, as they're drawing all the people that have familiarity with the message and who can be convinced to break away and start new churches, they're also getting other people who'd never heard or considered it before at the same time. And so there's a lot of capacity to do that in North America because William Branham was fairly widely known. There was also a lot of capacity to do that in Europe. William Branham had done multiple tours of Europe and had a lot of connections there, the same thing. And similarly in Africa, William Branham had been to Africa twice. He had done the same sort of bit where there were people there who were somewhat familiar with him. There were no formal message churches, but the same thing was happening in Africa. But as you get further afield, there's less places in the world William Branham went. But the Caribbean is another place that William Branham had went during his life. In 1960, it might have been 1961, the Full Gospel Businessmen sponsored a revival tour for William Branham in the Caribbean that year. And back then, if you remember, William Branham was in the middle of a tax fraud suit. He was not allowed to leave the United States. Like, there was travel restrictions on him. And so they had canceled, they had basically curtailed William Branham's ability to tour internationally for I would say, a good 7-8 years because of he was involved in the tax fraud suits. And they was afraid, obviously, if he went to you know, he went to Europe. Hey, he might not come back because he owes the government hundreds of thousands of dollars back taxes. So they wouldn't let him travel out of the country, but he was able to go to Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory. And while he was there, he's also able to go to Jamaica and some of the other countries down there, which I don't necessarily think you had to have a visa to get into. That's how he managed to pull that off. And so anyways, as he's died, this is another center for message people to make their pitches, where William Branham was known, where there was already pre-existing independent Assemblies of God mission networks. And what you have in the Caribbean is there is a man named Robert Lambert. Okay. Now, Robert Lambert was from Connecticut. He was generally called Bob Lambert. He was a independent Assemblies of God minister. That's where he came from. And he was more so a missionary than anything else. And he worked through the Caribbean. But when he was stateside, he was in Joseph Coleman's church, actually, in New York City, John. So he was a minister at local Christian assembly, the Joseph Coleman Church. And as we'll get in the future, Joseph Coleman in 1974 launches an independent sect of the message that becomes known as the Thunders. And so Bob Lambert, as he's doing this stuff in the Caribbean, you know, the Caribbean, it's primarily non-white people, right? In Jamaica, in Puerto Rico, that he's making inroads with. And Joseph Coleman is a natural fit. He's looking to go and kind of help out with some of that. And so they plant a number of churches, John, in Puerto Rico, in Jamaica, after William Branham died. They also planted churches in Trinidad and Tobago. They did the same in Aruba. They also, I know there was some mission work happening from my sect into Cuba and also Jamaica as well. And you see these churches starting to come together in the Caribbean right in that same period of time as you come onto the other side of that message schism. And they started doing that again. And in 69 and 70 was when they really started to plant those first churches there. And so that took off and started the message community in the Caribbean as we know it today.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Trinidad, which is one of the countries in the Caribbean. And one of the podcasts that we recently did, we were talking about the ebb and flow, the boom and bust cycles of Pentecostalism, how it grew and how once it got into the message that continued. A person who was reading through that read, who was listening to us, he read the comments, and I was watching as the people were commenting, and he said something to the effect, "Oh, this boom and bust cycle, it sounds to me like that's money laundering," which, you know, I'm not going to talk too much about that. There's some good research there if somebody wants to dig into it. But in Trinidad and Tobago, as the message is building up in this place, one of the big message leaders recently, as of, what was it, Charles, like 4 years ago, I think it was, got busted. I don't know the official outcome, but he was definitely charged with money laundering, and they traced, I don't know how many, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million that they were laundering through the church, and allegedly, and it all came because the country had been used heavily by other countries as a means to launder their money. And so they were changing the currency system and everything to try to eradicate it. Now, these countries have a heavy, heavy apostolic presence. So if you think about the boom and bust cycles and then think about what could potentially be going on, well, we know that it is happening to some extent because the law is cracking down, or was cracking down, and was trying to prevent the money laundering. So it's a side story. It's, you know, if somebody wants to, whoever commented, you can research. The name of the message person arrested was Vin Dayal, D-A-Y-A-L. But, you know, there were other people caught in the trap too, that they, when the government started cracking down. But anyway, you're right, the message spread into these countries, heavy apostolic presence. And to the people who are researching the charismatic movement, the NAR, and coming across this podcast, think of the presence of the charismatics in the Caribbean. I mean, it's a heavy presence, right? There's so many of them who, you know, they established all of these bases where I hate to say it, I've traveled to the Caribbean, and I would love to establish a base there so that I could take my family and have a good time in the Caribbean, right?
Yeah, so as things are getting kicked off in the Caribbean, the Bob Lambert kind of has a head start, and the Thunders, what will become the Thunders, kind of has a head start in getting the majority of the early community there planted. The main sect follows not long after, establishing churches, and then also my sect, primarily in Jamaica and Cuba, was where my sect had did some operation mission work and established some stuff. So that's happening early on. Like you mentioned, Vinworth Dial, his church, I believe, got started back in that period of time as well. His was more of a main sect aligned church in Trinidad when he got started. Another incredibly interesting church, you know, I would say Vinworth Dial is probably the most important church in the Caribbean. Second to him, I would say the most important one is a church Bob Lambert had planted, which evolved into, it's called Bethel Tabernacle, or Bethel House of God is the name of the church.
Yeah.
The present pastor is a man named Bruce Dalton, who's very famous in The Message for his series of books, The Exposition of Damnable Heresies. Now, this series of books has over 25 volumes, and they're all quite large. And if you want to know all kinds of bad things that everyone in The Message ever did, this man writes a series of books on it, The Exposition of Damnable Heresies, John. Every sect of The Message has whole books dedicated to all the bad things that they ever did. And so Bruce Dalton is a nut, John, an absolute nut of a man. But yeah, he was, in some ways, he considers himself to be Bob Lambert's successor in a lot of ways.
I remember I came across this name early on in my research. We were, gosh, I want to say it was within the first 2 or 3 months. And it came up in one of the forums. I used to have a, before Facebook groups and all of these things that exist today, I had the old school style forums where people could come out of The Message and we were talking. And I was reading through, I'd never heard of this name, and it came up in the forum, and one person was saying, it's almost like a badge of honor to get into his book of heresies, because if you make any sort of movement at all, this guy's going to write about you and just condemn you to hell, because that's his whole ministry, is condemning other groups to hell.
Exactly. I mean, the entire... Nobody knows what this church actually believes. We just know they hate everybody else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My sect of The Message was in there. Like, there is everybody in The Message gets called out by this guy.
Yeah.
Now, he's actually got, I actually have a little section in my book on his sect of The Message. He actually does have a little bit of a following in the Caribbean, in the United States, in Africa, and South America. He's got a small, minor regional sect of The Message, I would describe it. But yeah, that was a notable one that grew up in the Caribbean. Besides that, there's just a lot of planning happening in there. And one actually especially interesting thing about Bob Lambert, John, is Bob Lambert was actually murdered in, I believe the year was 1974. It was 1974, the same year we'll talk about this when we talk about the Thunders, but he got murdered in the Caribbean right when he turned on Joseph Coleman for preaching the Thunders, John.
Wow.
And so, you know, we'll talk about that. There's reasonably a chance that he was murdered by other Message people in that church. It seems likely, possible, he was actually murdered by members of his own congregation when he had turned on Joseph Coleman. Not necessarily for turning on Joseph Coleman, but right in that period of time. So we'll talk about that some more when we talk about the Thunders. But yeah, that's how The Message kind of got planted in the Caribbean. And the same thing, you know, he was going to places where William Branham was known, where there had already been some established presence, going to especially Independent Assemblies of God using their mission network and visiting churches that were already connected in some way to the Latter Rain movement. Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the surprising things to me. So all of these groups came into the, you know, into this area, Mecca, Jeffersonville, Indiana, for the conventions, and you would meet some of the different various groups. And because we're all under the same umbrella, we all have the same foundation. William Branham is the the prophet. The prophet has came to restore the hearts of the children to the fathers. We had this false notion that he actually restored the hearts to the fathers. And whenever when these people would come over, you would see things like this. I mean, they literally will murder people in the message communities in some of the other countries. In fact, if you go to my website, I don't have that searchable. I should probably make that searchable. But we have records, if you know where to look, of different groups that are killing Catholics, sometimes killing each other. Basically, if they believe two different things and one side or the other feels strongly enough about it, they will come out and do violence, physical harm. And so we were raised thinking that, you know, William Branham had spread the message and the people were all of the same mindset. They all loved one another in harmony. And then you realize that, no, it's not harmony. It's quite the opposite of that in other countries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some pretty serious violence that's occurred, especially outside of the United States around this stuff. Yeah, so, you know, if you, hey, you guys want to have a great read, The Exposition of Damnable Heresies, I have to recommend it. I have about almost every volume of this in print from them, John, from our Raymond Jackson collected them. He loved to collect everything, I tell you what. Yeah. So I have copies of some of those from him.
Well, it's dirt on everybody, so if you collect this and you want you want to have your way with somebody, you've got all the dirt right there in a book.
I know. Oh, boy. So I guess moving on to South America. So Bob Lambert, I should mention this. Samuel Johnson, I've talked about Samuel Johnson before, the child molester preacher from had a church in Michigan. He was an important mission center. He also, his church sponsored the first missionaries in that period of time into the Dominican Republic. And so that was happening in that period as well. His church also sponsored the first missionaries into Costa Rica in that same period and into Panama. And so they were kind of starting into Latin America right then. Now, down in South America, there were three centers of what I'll call mission message activity during this period of time. And I want to talk about all three of those in South America. Now, the first one is, this is, again, I would say this is probably the most mysterious one, because how this got started is so mysterious. But somehow, you know, before William Branham had died, Paul Schaefer had relocated from Germany to Chile, right? And so yeah. Paul Schaefer was in Chile, I believe from 1963, maybe 62, if I go back and look right. And he was already there when William Branham died, starting Colonia Dignidad, which was an isolated message commune, kind of associated with Ewald Frank and his sect of the message. We know Ewald Frank from Germany went to Colonia Dignidad multiple times, all the way up into the 2010s. I think 2015, 16, 17 was maybe the last time he's known to have been there. So there is stuff happening in South America in the message, and the stuff with Colonia Dignidad is the most mysterious of all, precisely how that links back to the message. Besides the known fact that they were message believers, that they had contact and known William Branham personally, and that Ewald Frank was visiting there, we don't know a whole lot about how they interacted with the message community in the broader world. But they were there in South America in the 60s and right up through this period of time, basically a cult operating a private military compound and doing all of the crazy stuff we've talked about in the Colonia Dignidad episodes.
It's really an unbelievable history when you think about what all happened in South America. I've covered some in my book from weaponized religion from Latter Rain to Colonia Dignidad, but there was World War III being waged covertly in South America. And we have, now that we have the declassified records from, you know, Nixon and various people, we can see what was going on down there. And like you said, in Colonia Dignidad, it was militarized. They had weapons manufacturing. They had sarin gas. They had all kinds of things. And it has made documentaries such as Hitler's Hunters and different places, because all the Nazis were coming in there. And the Nazis called it the colony, And so they would come into the colony, and then that's where they would land and hide out. Well, then there's this vast network of underground tunnels to get them into other countries. So they'd land first in Chile, and they'd go into Argentina and various places. But remember, this is also the country that, or the continent, I should say, that Jim Jones was at. Jones was in Guyana. So that's, if I remember correctly, that's a little bit northeast, if I remember correctly. So he's in Guyana. And this is about the same time that, you know, Jones was there, what was it, 1978, I think it was, whenever they started building the colony. But he was also there early. He took his family not long after William Branham started claiming that the prophet Nahum predicted that Outer Drive in Chicago was was going to come to be, and that there would be dropping an atomic bomb in Chicago and in I think he said Louisville, Kentucky. Well, that blast radius would have taken out Indianapolis. So Jones took his family down early into South America at that point. Now, what's really interesting is on my first video YouTube channel, I had this testimony of my own grandfather, and you probably knew this, not many people knew, but my grandfather suffered heavily with dementia during his later years, and he started talking. He started just opening up, and there was no filter. He would talk about things that, like, I never knew this about my grandfather, and I go look, and sure enough, he's telling the truth, but he's got no filter. Well, he started telling a testimony, and it was on video. He started talking about him and Billy Paul, which is William Branham's son, flying into South America, and they flew into Guyana. And Billy Paul apparently pointed down the plane out the window next to my grandfather and said, "That right there, that's where Jim Jones's compound was." And I put this on my website, which is, you know, a bombshell, right? Because at that time, nobody knew that Jim Jones was in the message cult. So I put it out there, and that was the first time that my website got attacked, and my YouTube, they actually did the copyright strikes against the YouTube to bring that particular video down, because they did not want to know that Billy Paul Branham and my grandfather were flying into Guyana.
Yeah, the Independent Assemblies of God. So I say back to Paul Schaefer just a little bit. It's so mysterious, you know, what was, you know, the linkages there. And as far as I know, I'm not aware of Paul Schaefer doing any sort of outreach to spread the message or anything like that, or to spread religion at all, really. They were very isolationist. So I'm not aware of really any spread of the ideology as a result of his activities. But the Independent Assemblies of God, who Paul Schaefer actually had been connected to when he was back in Germany. You actually find this in some of the Herald of Faith magazines. I think it's quite likely, based on what I can tell, that the Independent Assemblies of God was actually sponsoring the kind of the children's home that Paul Schaefer ran back in Germany. But the Independent Assemblies of God ran a fairly large mission network globally, and they had a lot of missions into South America. At that time, especially in Brazil and in Venezuela, you know, I haven't looked into Jim Jones a whole lot, but we know he was in the Independent Assemblies of God back then himself. Yeah. And it was probably through the Independent Assemblies of God network, mission network, that he had went into Brazil and Guyana the first time, which he went, I believe 1962 was the first time he went down there. Almost certainly as part of Independent Assemblies of God. I think if we looked into it, that's what we would find out. But the Independent Assemblies of God had missionaries all over the place down there doing stuff. And through that network, and I'll say the same as in the Caribbean, the same as the Independent Assemblies of God, that whole mission network was almost entirely financed by the Full Gospel Businessman, John, just like a lot of the mission network in Africa. The Full Gospel Businessman was paying for pretty well the whole thing during the early years. There was Perry Green. So William Branham sent Perry Green into Venezuela in 1965. I don't know if you're aware of this. So
no, I didn't know that.
Perry Green more or less converted to the message in 1964. And William Branham, the stories I was always told is William Branham couldn't stand Perry Green. and he tried to get rid of him. So he sent him to Venezuela. Is that, you know, the stories that come down in my sect of the message, you know. But, you know, so anyway, you take it or leave it for what it's worth. But anyways, William Branham sent Perry Greene to Venezuela, supposedly to get rid of him, according to the people in my sect of the message. So down Perry Greene goes to Venezuela, and he actually holds meetings in Venezuela. And as far as I know, he, with the support of the main sect of the message, and like he was a full gospel businessman and financing of the full gospel businessman, plants the original message community in Venezuela. And Perry Greene ends up with a pretty strong connection into Latin America and the Spanish-speaking areas. I would say he spearheaded a lot of that effort. And over the years, the Branham family especially, along with Perry Greene, were very directly involved in the planning and the spreading of the message in Latin America overall. So they had a direct hand in it. And a lot of the Latin American stuff is absolutely main sect, you know, or aligned either to Perry Greene after some of those things split off. So that was very, very, very big. My sect of the message, for example, we had no presence in South America. That was all main sect territory to us. So there was, however, so besides that stuff happening in Venezuela, before long, you know, they're doing stuff in other parts. But I would say by 71, 72, 73, they're operating in quite a few of the Central American countries, and Venezuela and Colombia to begin with. And so that's very, very important, very how a lot of that stuff got started there. Now, the next one we got to talk about. Now, this is by far the absolute most important one, John. So there was another missionary operating down there who I haven't been able to positively confirm he was part of the Independent Assemblies of God Mission Network. But I have to say he almost 100% was, because I know he attended through some different testimonies. This man attended the revivals hosted by People's Temple in 1950. Really? Yes, 1957. Yes, which was when they were all in the Independent Assemblies back God back then, right?
Yeah.
Jim Jones had been ordained by the IOAG back then, and that was the Independent Assemblies of God Brotherhood meeting. So the fact that he was there leads me to believe he was almost certainly also in Independent Assemblies of God. However, the legend is he was a Baptist, okay, who was at the Jim Jones. It don't quite add up to me that he was really a Baptist. No. He was almost certainly an Independent Assemblies of God minister, I would say. And his name is Archie Martin. Martin. No relation to the Martin brothers of Arkansas, as best I know, but he was from Indiana. His family lived around Indianapolis. From what I understand is his parents converted into the message in the 50s. They told him about how wonderful William Branham was, and he came back from mission work in South America to attend those meetings with his parents at People's Temple, John. He was amazed by what he saw with William Branham. He started collecting message literature, which was Independent Assemblies of God mission stuff back then. And he goes back to Brazil, and he starts proselytizing the message in Brazil. Now, he was very unsuccessful. He did not have a lot of good luck at it, okay? By the time he died, there maybe was 100 message believers in Brazil when he died, okay? And he died, I should look in my book to get the exact date. I want to say he died in 72 or 73, 1972 or 1973. So he died during this period of time as well. He died young, too. The cause of death, I am not sure. And he is, very interestingly, John, buried underneath a giant white pyramid. Okay. Yes. Okay. So this is the founder of the message community in Brazil. But during that window of time before he died, he came into contact with a man who is going to be very important in Brazil. And I always have trouble saying the names of this type, but I believe his name is Joaquim Silva. You can correct me if I'm wrong in how I'm pronouncing that, John, but Joaquim Silva, or maybe Joaquim Silva. Yeah. you know how to say it, John? Is that right?
I say Joaquim, but I think both are incorrect.
Okay. So we're going to say Joaquim Silva. My apologies to all of our friends in Brazil for butchering this man's name, but anyways, this particular man was a minister there who had he was an itinerant preacher. But when he intersected with Archie Martin, he more or less ends up becoming Archie Martin's lieutenant in the very tiny Brazilian message community. And he sets up, guess what, a radio station. You heard how that was radio stations was important to spreading the message in the United States and Europe. Well, he sets up a radio station in Brazil. And they're kind of in, I don't know, north central Brazil, from what I understand. And from that radio station, he starts attracting just a large, large following, John. And over the years, they grew into, from what they say, there's over 40,000 in his sect of the message at the present day, or, you know, I say in recent years. And pictures I've seen would suggest it's certainly maybe in the 5,000 range. There's pictures of, I would say, 5,000 of his followers at a single time. But they grew into a very large sect of the message over the years. I think we'll do maybe a full episode on them down the road. But that all grew out of the work of Archie Martin, who was the initial message missionary into Brazil, buried underneath the White Pyramid, who converted into the message through revivals at Jim Jones People Temple, John.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. I learned something from you every time we do one of these podcasts. I did not know that that was connected also to Jones, but you know, how can it not be? Jones was a big figure in the message cult, and if you take a step back and you go back in time to the latter rain, he was being primed as a leader of latter rain. You can look at the letters that you and I have shared from Joseph Matz and Bose introducing Jones to William Branham and basically setting him up. You got to meet this guy. This is a rising up and comer, right? And then they start holding these big conventions together. It looks very much like they were trying to create competition for the Voice of Healing movement and their conventions. So Jones is going to be there. Jones and Branham would be the star players, right? And then it just kind of fizzled out because of the, what was it? They said 300 ministers rose up against Branham over the serpent seed, and they started condemning Branham with all of these death prophecies in the charismatic movement.
They fight with the
AA one. Yeah. And so I had this conversation with somebody just, it was today. It was actually just today. The NAR says that Branham went astray in the later years, and they talk about how they rose in opposition. But the moment in which 300 ministers rose up and condemned him was in the 50s, you know, mid-50s. So this is like in the middle of his ministry, not at the end. And Jones was a key figure. Like you said, Jones goes down into South America. Now that I know that connection's there, I'm actually going to dig a little bit deeper to see how more widespread Jones's influence was in South America. But the connection, so all of these connections, if you really take a step back and ignore the religious side, just think a minute about the political side. Because the Full Gospel Businessmen, even though it is under the auspices of religion, it is a political movement. They're attracting businessmen, they're getting funding, they're working in the government systems. We've got photos, and we did an episode where they're connected to Nixon. Well, previously, whenever I was building up to the climax that I would eventually get to, it was Nixon that was helping, that was working with the colony, Colonia Dignidad, whenever they were setting up the operations to overthrow the government and install Augusto Pinochet as the dictator. So you've got the Full Gospel Businessmen who are working with Nixon administration, you know, they obviously work with other presidents too, but they were in collaboration, and they're sponsoring the entities that are going into the Caribbean, where there's, I'm not saying they're connected, but there's a heavy money laundering presence in the Caribbean. And you've got a business entity in the United States that is literally generating money for the religion. I'm not going to say those two are connected. You can think about that if you want. But why are they doing it? What is their mission? If their mission is to spread Christianity, it's really odd how they're doing it. You know what I mean? These people that they're choosing to spread it through into South America, it's like there's so many better choices, but they're choosing these guys to do it.
I don't know what to make of some of that, you know. You know, it's hard for me to know just exactly what to make of it. But hey, Bob Lambert, who started those churches in the Caribbean, came from a church that was ran by former members of the New York mob. Okay, I mean, it happened. I mean, what
were you they? You can't make this stuff up.
No, it really was. I mean, Pat Tyler and them, they were in the mob. Okay, no question about it. Okay,
yeah,
and so was the Branham family. I mean, okay, I don't know. I mean, and then the preachers that they planted to get arrested for money laundering. I mean, is it just a coincidence? Was there a conspiracy? I really don't know. I mean, I know Joseph Coleman's family went to jail for Ponzi schemes, you know? I mean, you can just go on the list, right?
Well, I'm not going to say it's connected, but Kenneth Hagin's brother openly admitted that he was in the mob.
you know, so, I mean, is it some sort of a vast conspiracy, or is it just a whole bunch of people seeing ways to get rich and, you know, it's coincidental? I don't know. Yeah. I kind of lean towards it's just a bunch of people all trying to get rich and, hey, that guy did it, I'm going to do it too, kind of a thing. But maybe it is. Maybe it is something bigger. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I've come to ignore the conspiracy theories and think of it like this. Here's a movement who trained and manipulated every head to believe that whenever the Bible talks about discernment, discernment meant detecting someone's diseases. That's what Branham taught in this movement, right? But discernment is discerning right from wrong. If you understand the Bible context, I've come to the conclusion that forget about all the conspiracy theories. Just look at the people that are involved with this thing. And yet, here's a people who trained others not to know how to apply discernment. There's some bad people because they did not use their discernment.
There's something funny going on in this, you know, in all of that side of stuff. There sure is. And just what, it is hard to lay your finger on it. But sure, a lot of them sure got murdered and went to jail, though. That is for sure. So it's strange. It's very strange. So that's South America. And let me point out one last thing before we maybe move on from South America. So Joaquim Silva, apologize for saying his name almost certainly wrong. Joaquim Silva was a rapist, and he died. I don't know if he was in prison when he died or he was still awaiting trial when he died, but he was a serial rapist as well. So, I mean, and Perry Green was a convicted felon and everything else. And none of this was good. I mean, every single central player here is some sort of a criminal deviant, okay? It's not good stuff, ladies and gentlemen. None of this is good stuff, you know. I mean, God have mercy, none of it is good stuff. So that's South America, John. Okay?
We've not even gotten to the good stuff yet.
Oh, man. Okay, so that's South America. And this is it. There is not a message church in the world that is not connected to this stuff, okay? Every single message congregation in the world today stems from this missionary outreach push I'm talking about that was led all by men like this. And not a one of them has clean hands, John. Not a single one of them has clean hands. I could tell you the dirt on every last one of them. I know it all, okay? We come from the second oldest message church in the world. My pastor kept dirt files on every last one of them. I know it all. And it's in the pages of this book, John, and it with footnotes, okay? So anyways, kind of moving on from South America, you get over to, let's talk about India, John. How about that? So that's South America. Moving over to India. India is another really interesting case. So William Branham had made a tour of India. This is the last place he made a tour of that we'll be talking about, you know, through the rest of the places. But he visited India. He had his tour there. The tour there was a massive flop. It was his most least successful tour ever. It was an absolute total flop. He came back to America and more or less, you know, hoped nobody would know that he, you know, would hear the story about it and just tried to forget about it. The tour was such a flop. But he did pick up a very important member into his cult following while he was in India. And we're going to do a full episode on this man down the road and his in his many activities. But his name was Paulasir Lowry. And Paulasir Lowry, like quite a number of people when William Branham went overseas, followed him back to the United States. And they moved to Jeffersonville. I'll tell you, we collected them from all over the world. They all came here. They all moved to Jeffersonville. They lived in our community. They went to our churches. And when William Branham died, they all returned from whence they came. Okay? And they took the message with them. And he was one who returned from whence he came. And he was here, you know, up through before William Branham and all them moved out to Arizona. And he went out to Arizona with them. There's actually pictures of him with Leo Mercer's park, him and William Branham standing together with Leo Mercer's commune trailer park in the background, right? So this is Paulasir Lowry. He goes back to India, John, and he is in the deity cult. He is deity cult to the core. He is hardcore deity cult too. He is part of the deity cult that baptized and pray in the name of William Branham, right? And made no bones about it. Like, he was that. He actually, his group pioneered the practice of praying in the name of the Lord Branham Christ. They pray to the Lord Branham Christ. They baptize in the name of the Lord Branham Christ. They're even crazier than Fred Sothman, John. I'm telling you, that's how bad. These are absolute nut. You know, this man's a nut. And he plants, he claims to plant by 1925, by 1975, he claims to plant 25 churches in India. How true that is debatable. And how many people there were was debatable, because I have a feeling that, you know, he imagined some of those people and some of those churches. But he did indeed successfully plant a number of message people in India. And some crazy stuff happened early on in his ministry, which we will talk about. And it ended up kind of going sideways on him. And the people who break out of that start to reach out to the broader message community because they had contact. For example, there's pictures of Paulasir Lowry visiting Creffield Free Mission and preaching there in the 60s, for example. He was connected to everybody. And as his group explodes and splits up, he convinced Americans to move to India with them, John. He convinced several people that he was the next manifested son of God, and a number of Americans and a few Europeans moved to India with him, thinking this was the case. And then when all that fell through, they reached back out to the United States. And missionaries from my sect of the message, missionaries from your sect of the message, all start to get invited to come visit to India. And so that is how they all primarily landed in India. It wasn't really through Independent Assemblies of God, but it was through the break of Paulasir Lowry's following, reaching out for help from the broader Last Door Message community. And that happened, you know, in the middle, and mostly the middle 70s when that happened, early to middle 70s when they broke up and reached out for more. But yeah, basically you get Cloverdale, actually, some of their early mission stuff was reaching out to some of that community in India. My church actually directly competed with some of that stuff back then, John. The way it worked, too, you know, I told you how, you know, in our past episode, how for a modest amount of money, you know, $10 a month, you could pay a message missionary to spread the message, right? Well, we discovered in our churches that there was a number of message preachers in India who were double dipping. They were taking our money and Cloverdale's money at the same time. And right. And so there was just this huge purge that happened in our Indian churches after that, because, you know, everyone who was taking Cloverdale money all got kicked out, because, you know, you had to, the twain don't mix. Like, here in the U.S., there was a dead line. And when we found out that the Indian preachers were taking Cloverdale money, and I think maybe Cloverdale ended up paying them more, is how they won them. But anyways, Cloverdale won a lot of them, paid them a little bit more money than us. But that's how it was a lot overseas. Whoever had the most money tended to tended to get the mission network, and that's just kind of how it went. But my sect of the message ended up with a number of churches. The main sect was probably the majority. We know Cloverdale sponsored a few. There was a few that always stayed, you know, crazy. Paula Zier Lowry, Manifested Sons of God, deity cult stuff as well. If you visit LordBranhamChrist.com, I kid you not, ChristBranham.com, that is the remnants of Paula Zier Lowry's cult, John, yeah. Actually. Yes, those are his successors in India.
You know, India to the message is the elephant in the room. And interestingly, there's a lot of elephants in India too. So, but India, if you think about what William Branham said and what he trained every one of his cult of personality to believe, which is that God was speaking through him and he was the prophet of the end times. Well, he used to make these sayings. He would say, if you find one minor detail with my prophecies that's incorrect, I'll put a sign on my back that says false prophet, and you can parade me through the streets. And I remember sermons about this, how not a single detail of his prophecies were incorrect. And it's odd now that I think about it, because in today's world, whenever we've gone through the prophecies and there's very few details that are actually even are correct, and they try to say, well, that's a trivial detail, you're just nitpicking. But that's not what the man said. He said one detail. Well, he said also, when I say, thus saith the Lord, you can count on it. Thus saith the Lord means God speaking through me. Well, he said, thus saith the Lord, when I land in India, there will be tens of thousands times thousands being saved. Now, mathematically speaking, that's 10 million, and he's saying there's multiple of these, so we're saying multiple of 10 millions are going to convert to the message when he lands. You've seen the photographs. I've seen the photographs. He may have got one little tiny church to invite him in, but the vast majority of India said, no, we're not having any part to do with this whacked out pastor, right? We don't want it. We're Hindus. We're Muslims. We don't believe this. And so he comes back and he admits it. He says, now, you know, the trip to India wasn't the success that I thought it should be. And he never really said, thus saith the Lord, prophecy is not what I thought it would be. And he makes up these weird excuses. You know, you can go look it up on my website. But this is the elephant in the room. If you are to believe that he's a prophet and God speaking through him and he's not lying, you have to believe that it would happen. So the point I'm trying to make with all of this, what's actually happened in India, what actually landed there, is so incredibly insane and not even close to Christianity. They worship Branham outright as a deity. So what they have there, what he actually made, was a bigger mess than what was there before, because they're worshiping him, they're praying in his name, they're baptizing in his name. And I've encountered these people. They've come on my website, especially when I posted the India prophecy, and they say, we are the fulfillment of this. And my first question is, okay, where are the 10 million people? And, you know, there's a handful of people. There's not a lot. There may be 1,000, I don't know, in India. There are, it's a growing number, but it will take decades to grow. And I don't think it ever can grow to the 10 million that he said.
Definitely not. There might be 10,000 message believers in India. There might even be, I'd have to go back in my book. I did some kind of detailed considerations when I wrote the book. There might be 20,000 message believers in India total. And there's a pretty sizable community there, but no, it is not even a fraction of what William Branham prophesied, thus saith the Lord. Close. It will be. No, I mean, it don't
and,
even.
And he said that when I return, you'll hear news of it. So he said, literally, they're going to have a revival that's going to make international news, and it didn't happen.
All the major sects of the message have a presence in India, and then there is obviously the remnants of the regional sect of Paula Zier Lowry and some few others. We'll talk more about that, I'm hoping deeply, in some other episodes. So kind of moving on. So that's how the message got started in India. It also got started in Pakistan as a result of that too, John. The Pakistan plants came a little bit after that, but people from India ended up planting some of the early churches in Pakistan as well, you know, in years that followed. Interestingly, there is also connections into Israel there too. Maybe we could you know, talk about that sometime. But there was just a lot of planting of message churches through that period of time in that part of the world as well. Now, the last two places we can talk about, hopefully we can fit them in, John. Next, we'll talk about the Philippines. So the Philippines is another very important area for the message. There's a very large message community in the Philippines as well. It also got started in this period of time, but towards the end of it. The very first missionary into the Philippines was a man named Gary Hart. He went to the Philippines, I want to say, I have the exact dates in my book, but I want to say it was 1971 was his first visit into the Philippines. And again, he's working within the Independent Assemblies of God framework. But he himself is sponsored out of the message church of the child molester in Michigan, Samuel Johnson. So that again is who is sponsoring the original message stuff into the Philippines. And we might have time. I don't know. We might down the road do maybe a full episode on the Philippines as well. But the same thing, you know, after they got started, something happened very early on. And I myself was not privy to the whole details of it, but there was some sort of a child molestation scandal that happened in the early message community in the Philippines that caused that to blow up. And then the same thing, you know, similar to happen in India or other places, as it blew up, the people there reached out to other factions of the message, invite them in to take the place of Gary Hart and Samuel Johnson. And so that's how then all, it kind of divides up and people get their invitations, you know, for the other sects of the message to plant their churches. Ewald Frank had been there a number of times working with Gary Hart in the very early days. And Ewald Frank was someone who, like I said, he was very ecumenical. He spread copies of literature from my sect of the message while he was there as well. So Ewald Frank gave the Filipinos in Gary Hart's community my sect of the message is literature. And so you see when they blow up, some of them reach out to our sect, some of them reach out to Ewald Frank, some of them reach out to Spoken Words, and they all get invited in, and then we all like carve up the Filipino pie. and you know, we all end up with churches in the Philippines. So that all happened in the middle and late 70s, John. So that's how the message got kicked off in the Philippines.
Ewald Frank seems to be key in spreading into the worst places and creating the worst messes. I know when we get into Africa, there's some funny stories that we can get into with what he created there, but this is a mess, Charles.
Let's try to wrap up. Maybe we can give just a real quick say something about Australia and New Zealand, see if we can fit into this episode real quick. So how did the message get into Australia and New Zealand? That's a really interesting one. And you've had some interviews from New Zealand and Australia, I believe, in your podcast before as well. But the message never sent, while William Branham was living, no one ever went to the Philippines. No one ever went to New Zealand or Australia, you know, from the central institutions. But the Independent Assemblies of God was spreading message literature, and they did have mission type work happening in New Zealand and in Australia and in that part of the world. And somehow through that network, William Branham's literature and tapes started to get into the hands of some people in those countries, subscribers to Herald of Faith, Voice of Healing, and through just some of the other ministers in the broader network. And what happened, John, and this started, I want to say, within 1 year of William Branham's death, you have a number of people in New Zealand, churches in New Zealand and in Australia, reach out to the central institutions of the message. They reach out to Spoken Word Publications. They reach out to the Branham Tabernacle, and they request more literature. It's kind of like happened in Western Europe with the UPC minister, Garrison. They request more literature. We would like more of this that we have, you know, obtained. And they start sending more. And before long, invitations get extended to message preachers from North America to come visit these churches, which had been impacted by the Latter Rain movement through other factions. And they develop an especially close connection to Perry Green and to the Branham family in the main sect of the message. And so they're going over there. So they're very, very much main sect aligned, you know, in my understanding of everything over there. Now, my sect of the message and some of the others did plant some churches in that area in later years, but right in these first years, it was all pretty well main sect. And it was actually them initiating the connections after having obtained message literature from best I could tell through the Independent Assemblies of God network of churches and mission work.
Yeah, I do the, as you know, the Our Stories every Friday. I've been doing it for a couple of years now. And Raewyn Theobald, if you want to go back and you can hear her story of how she gives a pretty good history of how the message kind of built up in the community that she was in. And she said that it was the, how did she term it, the mother's church or something like that? It was the main church, basically, in that area that the message spread from. But so many people, you know, once they realize that this mess isn't what it was supposed to be, that William Branham wasn't who he said he was, then they realize that once you start looking at all of the other cultures and how the message spread, you start realizing that it's not even really a connected religion. No two churches are the same. In most cases, if two message churches are in the same city in the United States, they won't fellowship with each other. The main sect knew these things, and they're working with them to help spread it because there's money in it. So as this thing is being pushed far and wide, they really don't care who does it. As long as it spreads and as long as it grows and as long as it can earn another buck.
I think one thing that is important to point out about this early message mission push, John, you know, when William Branham died in 1965, every single person in the message community knew and met and saw and heard William Branham with their own eyes.
Yeah.
By the time you get to 1974 on the other side of this mission push, that's not true anymore. The message community by the other side of this is now a majority of people who never saw William Branham, who never met William Branham, who, you know, the people in New Zealand never met William Branham. People in Australia never met William Branham. The people that, you know, mostly that was converted in India and the Philippines and Africa and South America, they never met William Branham, right? You get to a state where the majority didn't know him, and they are indeed functioning on legends, which the previous people who did know William Branham has told them. And so this thing has already entered into, you know, within 5 to 10 years of William Branham's death, the majority of people are purely operating on legends, which none of them have the least bit of eyewitness connection to. And it's men, and you have these people, often they would travel together, Perry Green, Lee Vail, Ewald Frank, you know, or Raymond Jackson and different, you know, ones who were, you know, the eyewitnesses. They would back each other up in these mission pushes. And Lee Vail would say, yes, I saw this and that was true. And Perry Green, yes, I saw this and that was true. And Ewald Frank say, yes, I would see this and that was true. You know, and the people listening, they don't know. They have no idea whether it's true or not. They're taking them at their word. And the truth is, just like William Branham was deceiving a lot of people in his work, in the things he was doing, the same thing we can find in their pushes and what they were saying. His disciples were also deceiving about William Branham. You know, I'll give you just a couple examples. You know, Ewald Frank, for example, would always talk about in his one of his mission talks was how that in 1958, he came to a meetings in the United States, and William Branham discerned that he was a preacher. And this was a great, fantastic miracle. But he never told the audiences that he'd actually met William Branham 3 years earlier and was his interpreter. Don't you think he already knew he was a preacher? Right? There's things like that. Or you take Joseph Coleman doing the same thing. Oh, Joseph Coleman is on tape. There is a discernment where William Branham calls out Joseph Coleman on tape and discerns that he's came to church because, oh, his father has cancer, I believe, and that's why he's came to that meeting to have prayer for his father. Oh, it's a wonderful discernment. But Joseph Coleman never points out to people that he had already been in the message for over a year when that happened, right? And had already visited the Branham Tabernacle and the people knew. They're lying. Yeah. They're lying. They are deceiving. They are keeping up the like, they know. They know that they participated in hoax discernments, John. They know there are things that are wrong, but they will use things that they know are wrong, that they participated in being wrong as part of their pitch, right, to sell the message. Perry Green did the same thing. Raymond Jackson did the same thing. Every one of them did it. You can find elements in their stories where they absolutely knew it was fake, but they included it in their testimonies of trying to sell William Branham to the masses. And, you know, it's hard to excuse that on this side of things, but the people out and about in New Zealand and the Philippines and all, they didn't know any different, right? These people come telling them all this stuff, they accept it, they believe it, and they're drawn into the message under false pretenses. And all of this stuff is just entered the realm of legend now. And you see it even in the feeds, John. William Branham was the vindicated prophet. No, he wasn't. He was not. Like, that is just a catchphrase, vindicated prophet. William Branham was never vindicated. And all of this stuff built on just legends that started this whole thing. Legends of a brainwashed people who were trying to go out to recruit people into the message to make themselves feel better, John, because their prophet had died and their religion had been proven to be a hoax. That is what is happening. There's a book out there called When Prophecy Fails. Believe the Sign actually recommended it. And it is a common feature of religious cults that when some critical event happens that would challenge their belief system in terms of failed prophecy, like the death of their prophet who was supposed to be the restorer, it is very natural for the immediate aftermath of that to be a schism. People run away that have good critical thinking, and the people that remain almost always go on a mission outreach, John. And that is part of the attempt to make themselves feel better. They go out and they're recruiting more people because as the new people come in, it reinforces them. Oh, yes, we're right. See, even these new recruits believe. It's part of the coping mechanism of cognitive dissonance to go out and recruit new people to help reinforce yourself in the aftermath. And that fits the pattern of the message perfectly.
You know, a prophet is vindicated by whether or not his prophecy came true or not. And that's what many of these people were manipulated to think it means something else. You can be vindicated by a light above your head or because he said he's vindicated or something like this. But in the end, a prophet is vindicated by whether or not his prophecies, all of them, came to pass. And India is a clear example. There are not 10 million people, tens of millions of people in India who are converted to the message. But in the end, for me, what I see happening is they weren't selling Christianity. And I think this is the thing that people, if you're in the message and you're listening to this, you really need to understand. It's not that they're selling Christianity. They're not bringing the hearts of the children to the Father, which is that was heavily advertised. He's the prophet of Malachi 4. He's bringing the hearts of the children to the Father. What they were selling was a mythology. Every single person that we have mentioned in this episode and the last one, whenever they went out and they spread the message, what they did was they spread the mythology. They didn't go say, Jesus Christ has died on the cross for your sins and you too can be saved. They said, hey, did you know that there's a mythology? We have a prophet and he had a halo and he had all of these things. And most of the mythology, like you said, they're lying about half of it. Some of these people who are spreading this know that many of these things failed. But they would say, my grandfather would say it. My grandfather was there when things failed. But my grandfather would say, it never failed one single time, folks. It's more accurate than today's newspaper. And he would say this over and over and over again. And then when you find that it actually did fail, I'm like, grandfather, why did you say this to the people? Why were you lying to the people behind the pulpit? And for me, in the end, it comes down to this. My grandfather supported the mythology more than he supported Christianity. And it's very hard for me to say that because that's awful to think about my grandfather. But think about all these other men that are doing it. They're all spreading the mythology. And we're going to talk next episode. We're going to talk about as it spread further. What are they selling? They're selling the mythology. And for me, that's the clear dividing line of what this is. Is this Christianity or is this something else? And if they're selling a mythology instead of Christianity, it is clearly something else.
I think that is all very well said, John. And you are exactly right on the vindication piece. And with William Branham, it's not even that we need to vindicate him as a prophet. That whether he was a prophet or not does not make the message a valid religion. What makes the message a valid religion is William Branham has to be the Elijah prophet of Malachi 4.
Yeah.
He has to be vindicated for that, for the message to be a valid religion. And there is no validation, vindication for that specifically. There is zero. There never has been. There never was. And the only way to vindicate it is to read that verse and say, did he actually restore the hearts of the children to the Father? and you look at the cult, John, were the fathers rapists and child molesters and thieves and robbers and all this? No, but that's what William Branham's followers were. Okay? So, no, he did not return their hearts to, he did not fulfill that verse, right? And it is outrageous to say otherwise.
It's unbelievable. And you're right, he wasn't what he said he claimed to be. And so as we're going to get into, as we go further with this, because of this, because men who are leading this, and I'm using the term men because there are very few women who lead the message, they're the men who are leading this, realize that he was not who he said he was. And so what you ended up with coming next, and we'll get into it further, is you started spawning off all this new group of people who said that they were the ones who were coming. They were the prophet of the last days. And that's going to be a little bit fun when we get into that. But anyway.
Isn't it an admission that he didn't turn the hearts of the fathers back if the other people now need to do it? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
If other people now need to do it, obviously he didn't. And therefore, obviously, he was not the Elijah. And therefore, the entire religion is something's wrong upstairs, yeah. John. People aren't thinking straight.
Here in Jeffersonville, they're all congregating because the son is supposed to be the one who will lead the children back to the hearts of the fathers. But we could go on and on. You get the picture. It was a mythology. This is not Christianity, folks. If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about the history of William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. Both available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.